When was the most dangerous time to be alive? When have we humans had the most to fear from our fellow man? It can feel at times that today the threat of violence lurks at every corner. The news feeds us stories about violence 24 hours a day. Indeed, a recent study found that 96% of news stories about crime are about violent crime. 52 people every hour lost their life to violence in 2021, over 1,000 a day. And that was just from homicide. As of 2024, there are also 110 armed conflicts taking place worldwide, with some having lasted for more than 50 years. And so, is this the most violent time to be a human? Perhaps not. Understanding human violence and its prevalence requires a deep search into our ancestral past, where survival and competition forged the traits that would come to define so much of our future. Violence, in its many forms, is not a modern invention, but rather a complex behavior deeply rooted in the evolutionary history of our species. And exploring it reveals much about what it means to be human. When we think about violent periods in human history, we may think of the globe-spanning world wars of the 20th century. Our thoughts might turn to the medieval period. The Crusades, the Mongol invasions, and the Hundred Years' War all led to catastrophic loss of life. Indeed, some historians put the death toll of Genghis Khan's conquests at 11% of the world's population at the time. Even further back, the Roman Empire's decline brought about centuries of chaos during the so-called Dark Ages, with marauding tribes, political instability, and the collapse of urban centers leading to widespread violence bred from insecurity. But despite this, we may in fact be living through a time of peace, by the standards of deep history. Archaeological evidence suggests that prehistoric humans lived in a state of near-constant warfare, where the threat of violence from other humans was ever-present. Skeletal remains from this era frequently show signs of violent death, with many individuals, including women and children, bearing the marks of brutality. In these early days of humanity, the violence may not have met the scale of modern warfare, but it was ubiquitous and indiscriminate. Today, less than 1% of deaths are caused by violence. Yet when we look at our oldest ancestors, we find an average of over 3 times that, with some periods being 20 times more violent than today. And so what was the reason behind our ancestors' violent nature? Is it true that we have become, by comparison, a peaceful species? Or deep within us, are we still destructive at heart? More than 50 countries and over 100 million soldiers were involved in World War II, from the defense of Westerplatte in 1939 to the Battle of Okinawa in 1945, there was violence on a scale never before seen. In the expansive golden plains of Amboseli, a cheetah's keen eyes catch a flicker of movement. In an instant, it springs into action, targeting an unsuspecting hare. With unmatched speed, the cheetah closes the distance in mere seconds. The hare, sensing danger too late, attempts to flee, darting away in a frantic zigzag pattern. And what follows is a gripping chase, a primal dance between two of nature's most fundamental drives: hunger and survival. The cheetah, the embodiment of speed and precision, matches the hare's every desperate move. It weaves left, then right, mirroring the hare's erratic escape. The plains, usually still and serene, are now alive with this high-stakes pursuit. Each twist and turn, each split-second decision, could mean the difference between life and death. Of course, for the hare, survival is the only goal. Its small bursts of speed and sudden changes in direction challenge its pursuer. But the predator's superior speed and endurance gradually close the gap. In a final, decisive moment, the cheetah gathers all its power for one last lunge. With claws extended and jaws open wide, it strikes. The cheetah's precision and the hare's desperate attempt to escape collide in a split second, and the cheetah secures its meal. The predator-prey relationship is a mesmerizing dance of survival. At its core, it pits two creatures against each other, each seeking to survive the harsh environment of the wild. But this battle is about so much more. Predators and prey are in an ever-evolving arms race, with each adaptation in one sparking a counter-adaptation in the other. Natural selection has driven predators to evolve a variety of features beneficial to hunting and consuming meat. Features like sharp claws and teeth, keen eyesight, stealth, and in some cases teamwork and mental ingenuity. Prey animals, meanwhile, have their own arsenal of defenses, including camouflage, speed, and physical deterrence, like spines or toxins. And so the battle is never-ending, their populations becoming intertwined in a fascinating cyclical pattern. When prey populations surge, predators enjoy a feast and their numbers rise. However, if predators overindulge and decimate prey populations, they face famine, causing their numbers to plummet. In this way, the dynamic is essential for maintaining the delicate balance of ecosystems, profoundly shaping populations, driving evolutionary adaptations, and impacting ecological health. The drive to kill, then, is absolutely fundamental to species across the animal kingdom. It's not just a part of survival, but also essential to maintaining balance in the environment. But what about killing for other reasons? What drives animals to kill their own species, even members of their own pride or herd, if not the predator-prey relationship? And where do humans fit into this brutal world? Creatures across the animal kingdom are known to kill members of their own species. This is known as intraspecies killing. The reasons behind intraspecies killing are numerous, but they almost always stem from a fundamental need to survive and reproduce. Territorial disputes, for example, can inspire fierce violence. The drive to defend a territory is fueled by several critical needs: securing access to vital resources like food and water, attracting and maintaining mates, and establishing or reinforcing social status. For many animals, the territory is not just a physical space, but a vital component of their survival and reproductive success. Indeed, male tigers are especially notorious for their fierce dedication to protecting their domain. They will go to extreme lengths to ensure that no rival, not even their own siblings, encroaches on their territory, and the consequences of such disputes can be deadly. One such incident occurred in Lucknow, India. The tiger not only defeated its rival in a deadly fight, but also dragged the lifeless body into the forest. In a shocking display of dominance and territorial aggression, the victorious tiger consumed parts of the defeated rival's body. And competition for reproductive success among animals can be just as brutal. A striking example of this is seen in male northern elephant seals, who engage in fierce and bloody battles to gain control over harems of females. And these intense conflicts are not brief skirmishes, they can drag on for hours, with the massive bull seals using their powerful bodies and sharp teeth to tear chunks of flesh from their rivals. And even once the young are produced, that is far from the end. Male and female animals will die and kill to protect their children. Grizzly bear mothers are notoriously aggressive in defending their cubs. They will attack and kill any perceived threat, which can include humans and other bears. 70% of grizzly bear attacks on humans in North America are by females protecting their young. But perhaps the most shocking kind of violence to our eyes is infanticide, the killing of young, a surprisingly common occurrence in the natural world. Indeed, this type of murderous behavior could be as prevalent as being committed by 25% of all mammal species. But what could possibly prompt the destruction of defenseless young? Infanticide is most often driven by a desire to ensure a male's genetic supremacy. By killing a rival's offspring, a male can guarantee only their children will benefit from the resources available to a group. When male lions take over a new pride, for example, they will usually kill all the existing cubs, thereby ensuring that the previous male's progeny is eradicated and only their own, future cubs will live on in the pride. It's even been supposed that female lions can recognize the roars of infanticidal lions, and have been observed hiding their cubs after the arrival of a new male in order to protect them from the inevitable slaughter. Even dolphins, often thought of as friendly and playful creatures, have a dark side. They've been observed killing the young of rival males to increase their own reproductive success. And so when we look to the wild, we see that violence is brutal and indiscriminate, not only between predator and prey, but also family members and even offspring. It would be tempting to think that violence is more common among antisocial animals, creatures that stalk lonely paths with few social connections, who are unable to get along with others. But when zoologists have looked more deeply at the violence we see in the natural world, they've actually found that lethal violence appears more common in social, territorial animals compared to isolated, non-territorial animals. Perhaps then, familiarity breeds contempt. When living in close quarters, rivalries, competition, and desire can be powerful influences. And being both social and territorial, primates are exactly the type of animal expected to exhibit violent behaviors, something we see borne out in statistics. Researchers analyzed data from 1,024 species of animal, including 102 primate species. They found that intraspecies killing is relatively rare, occurring in only around 0.3% of mammal deaths. However, among primates, this rate is significantly higher, at approximately 2%. And when the researchers looked through historical evidence, they found that pre-human species displayed a level of lethal violence that aligns with this primate tendency of around 2% intraspecies deaths. But that is not to say that we are the most violent mammals out there. A whole 8% of hyena deaths are caused by other hyenas, and meerkats, those cute, doe-eyed little mammals, are surprisingly murderous, with around 20% of their deaths attributable to other meerkats. And so on the whole, while primates, including humans, might not be the most murderous, they're certainly above average when it comes to displaying violence. And so, what does this mean for us? Are we inherently more violent than other creatures? And if so, when did this violence start? To answer this question, we will have to journey back into our distant past. Over 5,000 years ago, there lived a man now known to us as Ötzi. Ötzi roamed the Tyrolean Alps, a cold and snowy mountain range between modern Italy and Austria. As he hiked the ridges and peaks, he carried with him a copper axe, a bow and arrows, and flint knives. His body bore the signs of a life lived on the edge, scarred and beaten. But one day, trudging high into the mountains, Ötzi felt the pointed end of an arrow pierce his shoulder. As he succumbed to the blood loss, perhaps watching the snow turn red at his feet, he may have turned his face upwards to look at the vast blue sky as he breathed his last icy breath. And 5,000 years later, we've been able to study Ötzi's frozen body, preserved for millennia in the icy ground. We've learned that the arrowhead that was lodged in his shoulder came from behind and severed a major artery. Unhealed cuts and bruises on his hands, wrists and chest suggest a fight 1 or 2 days prior to his death, and there were signs of trauma to the head, perhaps a final blow to finish off the man as he lay dying. The blood of 4 others were found on Ötzi's body and equipment. A working theory is that Ötzi got into a fight, and days later, as he strode up into the mountains on an errand or a hunt, his opponent followed. Quietly trailing him through the undulating peaks, he took his chance, firing an arrow into Ötzi's back and felling him. Perhaps the attacker brought a group of friends, and they all helped end Ötzi's life, shedding blood from their own injuries as he tried to fight them off in vain. Or perhaps Ötzi's own friends discovered him injured, fought off his attackers, and tried to help their comrade. We will never know for sure. But what we do know is that up in the Alps, 5,000 years ago, a man lost his life at the hands of another human being. And so Ötzi's body shows us that humans have long been capable of planning and executing a terrible level of violence. But he's just the tip of the iceberg. We can travel much further back in time than Ötzi, further back even than modern humans. Let's begin our journey in what is now Spain, in the Atapuerca Mountains, just under 500,000 years ago, for something sinister happened here. At a site called Cima de los Huesos, in English, the Pit of the Bones, there lies the remains of at least 28 individuals belonging to a group of early Neanderthals. Neanderthals and modern humans coexisted in various regions of Europe and Asia for tens of thousands of years before Neanderthals became extinct around 40,000 years ago. Evidence suggests that there was not only competition, but also interbreeding between the two species, leading to a small but significant amount of Neanderthal DNA in modern human populations. This genetic legacy has contributed to certain traits in modern humans, such as skin pigmentation, immune responses, and possibly even susceptibility to certain diseases. It also means that the behaviors we can find evidence for in Neanderthals might have become part of our own through this interbreeding and cultural exchange, including violent behaviors. Those buried at Cima de los Huesos were mainly young adults, from late teens to their early 30s, with a few older adults and younger children. This is a good sign of just how tough life could be, few individuals making it into adulthood, and even fewer to old age. However, further insight into what befell the buried people at Cima de los Huesos has been offered by one particular skull. Cranium 17. A male, he was likely the subject of an attack. The skull bears two significant fractures on the forehead, just above the left eye socket. These injuries are not only severe, but also strikingly similar in shape and size. The fractures are deep, resulting from blunt force trauma, likely inflicted by a rounded object, possibly a stone tool or a club. But what makes these fractures particularly telling is their placement and symmetry. The injuries are positioned in a way that suggests the blows were intentional, delivered with force, and aimed to incapacitate or kill. He was likely struck twice in quick succession. The similarity of the wounds indicates that the same object was used for both strikes, suggesting a deliberate act of violence rather than an accidental injury. Given the severity and the location of the wounds, it's almost certain that these blows were fatal. And so though we can't know for certain, this might be evidence of the earliest case of murder yet found. And there are many more examples of violence among these uncles on our evolutionary tree. In Iraq, the damaged bones of a male Neanderthal who lived around 50,000 years ago were discovered in a cave. He was found to have suffered a rib injury caused by a sharp projectile weapon, like a thrown spear. Perhaps he was killed over territory or died in a conflict with neighboring humans. Maybe he was dragged into the cave away from danger by friends, or crawled into the cool, dark space to die. And this male certainly isn't the only example of a violent Neanderthal death. An even more disturbing case occurred nearly 100,000 years earlier. Multiple Neanderthal bodies have been uncovered, buried in the Krapina cave in Croatia. These bones display cut marks and fractures that are consistent with perimortem trauma, wounds inflicted at the point of, or immediately after, death. And so what could have motivated aggressors to not only kill, but to mutilate the bodies? It's been suggested that these markings might be evidence of cannibalism. The many broken bones and cracked open marrow channels could be signs that Neanderthals used tools to extract bone marrow from the dead. This would be consistent with other archaeological evidence that points to Neanderthals resorting to cannibalism when food ran low and hunting was scarce. But the markings on the skulls in particular at Krapina Cave might tell a different, less horrifying story. One of ritual. The scratches on the skulls are not, some archaeologists say, consistent with removing brains, as one would do if the intention was consumption. It is proposed that instead, the damage is a sign of love and respect, a last rite. This view is bolstered by the discovery that 11 of the Neanderthals found buried exhibited signs of healed injuries that would not have been survivable without the care of others. Some of the bones were found with evidence of trauma that would have resulted in pain and required cleaning and care. And two of the skeletons had damage to their spines that would likely have left them with limited mobility, necessitating ongoing support. But despite this, there are discoveries that are less ambiguous. In France, the La Ferrassie 1 Neanderthal skull was found with a deep fracture caused by a blow to the head, while in the El Cidron caves in Spain, the remains of 12 Neanderthals, dated to around 49,000 years ago, show signs of multiple cut marks and fractures that are consistent with an assault. These examples collectively underscore the complexity of Neanderthal life, indicating that violence, whether through conflict, accident, or ritualistic behavior, was a normal part of their existence. The evidence from sites like Shanadar, Krapina, La Ferrassie, and El Cidron reveals that Neanderthals were not only capable of violent behavior, but also that they experienced and possibly engaged in acts of violence for many different reasons. And so what does this all mean for Homo sapiens, related to, but still separate from Neanderthals? As we trace the fossil record away from our evolutionary cousins and uncles, and on to the human named as thinking man, do these instances of extreme brutality persist? What can the bones of our own species reveal? The first Homo sapiens emerged around 300,000 years ago in Africa. They would be recognizable as human to us, owing to their anatomical similarity, though some slight differences in appearance include a prominent forehead and smaller brow ridges. These early humans were highly adaptable and resourceful, living as hunter-gatherers with a deep understanding of their surroundings. They used sophisticated tools made from stone, bone, and wood, and were likely capable of complex language and symbolic thought, as suggested by evidence of early art and burial practices. Socially, they lived in small, nomadic groups, cooperating for hunting and foraging while sharing knowledge across generations, which laid the foundation for the development of more complex societies. But they also experienced hardship and competition. We can learn a little of the darker side of their life from the remains of at least 61 Homo sapiens buried in a cemetery at Jebel Sahaba in Sudan, some 13,000 to 14,000 years ago. This is one of the earliest known mass human graves, and around 40% of the skeletons have clear evidence of trauma, wounds from weapons piercing their bodies, broken bones, and blunt force trauma. Indeed, the grave is believed to be the site of a litany of intergroup conflicts, perhaps a succession of raids for resources acted out by early humans on other clans. And this story of violence continues a few thousand years later, in Ataruk, Kenya. 10,000 years ago, attackers killed and pillaged what appeared to be an entire community. The victims at Nataruk were members of a hunter-gatherer community living near a lagoon on the edge of Lake Turkana. The aggressors massacred at least 27 people, including men, a pregnant woman, and children. The absence of many female skeletons suggests abduction of women of childbearing age. The fact that it was not just adult males, but also children among the dead, indicates that this was not some small tussle, but a massacre that targeted an entire community with the specific goal of annihilation. The Nataruk site provides evidence that organized violence, including massacres, occurred among prehistoric hunter-gatherer groups, and are not just the reserve of more modern societies. Many of the skeletons display head wounds, and a large number of males have devastating damage to their legs, ribs, and hands. Arrowheads were found embedded in bones, and some of the remains were discovered in positions that suggested they had been bound. And finally, the weapons used were not local. This indicates that this may well have been a violent onslaught by a group traveling in search of resources. When they saw that this community had exactly what they needed, lush lands, fertile hunting grounds, they took it by force. The evidence echoes that of other human massacre sites, ranging in time period from 10 to 7,000 years ago. Near modern-day Vienna, a mass grave of 200 people, a jumble of shattered bones and pierced skulls, an entire society wiped out. At Schönekirchenstaden in Germany, another mass grave of adults and children targeted in an act of early warfare. The leg bones of the young men had been systematically shattered. And in Halberstedt, yet another mass grave of bodies dumped unceremoniously, all with severe cracks to the skull delivered, apparently, after death. A seemingly unnecessarily violent conclusion to an already won fight. These findings show that even nomadic hunter-gatherers engaged in violent conflicts, possibly over resources or territory. Indeed, these discoveries challenge the notion that large-scale violence only emerged with the development of more complex societies. Instead, they hint that the capacity for violence has deep evolutionary roots, perhaps as a survival mechanism or a means of establishing dominance. And so while it might be impossible to conclusively state that we are inherently violent beings, the evidence from prehistoric and early human graves points to an uncomfortable truth. From our earliest origins, we have carried the potential to inflict terrible and lethal harm upon each other. The fact that violence against our own species has been present since such an early stage of human history suggests that aggression may be a fundamental part of how we function. As we trace the branches of our evolutionary tree, the persistent presence of violence might suggest that it's not merely a byproduct of civilization, but a core element of our human nature, shaping our history and social dynamics for millennia. It almost seems that aggression is fundamental to the way we function, and so could it be embedded in our very DNA? Is violence a genetic legacy passed down the generations, traveling through the branches of our evolutionary tree? In 1974, deep in the Tanzanian jungle, there was a war. A community of chimps had separated into two groups, the Kahama breaking off from the original Kasakila to establish a new home in nearby territory. These groups would go on to spend 4 years in conflict, engaging in regular, violent battles that ultimately would lead to the complete eradication of the Kahama. But what is particularly interesting and surprising about this war is that for the first time, we saw that chimpanzee violence was sophisticated. The Kasakila performing ferocious ambushes on the Kahama males, coordinating the attacks for when the victims were alone, before proceeding to set upon them in a gang of multiple males. These attacks showed that these chimpanzees were not acting irrationally or randomly. They were strategic, using violence as a means to an end. This was one particularly shocking example of chimpanzee violence, but these apes are known for their complex social behaviors, including violent tendencies that are often driven by competition for resources, status, and mates. Indeed, both in the wild and captivity, chimpanzees engage in aggression that can result in serious injury or even death. Male chimpanzees, in particular, are known for forming coalitions to assert dominance within their social groups, often through violence. Studies have shown that these coalitions allow males to increase their access to mating opportunities and improve their standing within the group hierarchy. The behavior of the Kasakila chimps is often seen in other chimp communities and is known as lethal raiding. It is shockingly premeditated, serving not only to eliminate competition, but also to expand territory and access to resources. Gorillas, meanwhile, who we are more distantly related to, appear generally less violent than chimpanzees. This is probably linked to being less territorial. Ranges of gorilla groups often overlap. But when resources are low or there is instability in a group, for example, when an alpha male dies, violence can break out in both males and females. Male gorillas, especially silverbacks, are known to be fiercely protective of their group. They may start chest beating, loud vocalizations, and even physical attacks. Violence within their group has also been seen, particularly among males, though studies have shown that such aggression is often ritualistic, meant to establish or reaffirm hierarchy within the troop, rather than cause serious harm. And finally, like chimpanzees, gorillas enact infanticide, with male gorillas killing the offspring of rival males to eliminate competition and ensure their own reproductive success. Up to 5% of gorilla infants die by infanticide, and around a quarter of infant deaths are at the hands of male gorillas. And so these examples beg the question, why is violence preserved so strongly in the primate lineage? From combining insights from zoology, anthropology, and modern psychology, we can begin to understand why fighting is so important. To begin with, a certain level of violence can ensure survival. By fighting off other males, male chimpanzees and gorillas ensure they get priority in breeding, and so pass on their more aggressive genes. And stronger, more aggressive males are better protectors of their mates and offspring, and are more likely to be successful in maintaining alpha status within their group, ensuring not only that they pass on their genes, but that the carriers of those genes prosper. In short, a primate ensures the survival of his genes if he is violent, and the group is simply more successful when males are strong and aggressive. But this is not the whole story. To understand the picture more fully, we need to talk about bonobos. Native to the dense rainforests of the Congo Basin in Central Africa, bonobos are our second closest relatives and live in matriarchal societies. This female-centered structure contributes to overall harmony within groups, as it helps to mitigate conflict and promote cooperative behaviors. In fact, bonobos take getting along to a whole new level. Lovers, friends, even strangers are quite happy to get exceptionally amorous if the mood takes. Their social interactions offer an insight into the potential for peaceful coexistence in social animals, including humans. However, this is not to say that there is no aggression among bonobos. Males have been observed kicking, hitting, and punching other males in the group, indeed more often than even the chimpanzees do, but the fighting is mild, and no bonobo murder has ever been recorded by humans. This suggests that while violence is present among our primate relatives, so too are mechanisms for peaceful coexistence and conflict resolution. And so how do these behaviors shed light on the behavior of humanity? We parted ways with chimpanzees, our closest relatives on the tree of life, between 6 to 7 million years ago. Indeed, humans share approximately 98 to 99% of their DNA with chimpanzees. And yet despite this genetic closeness, the difference in the remaining 1 to 2% has a huge impact. This tiny slice of DNA contributes to distinct physiological, cognitive, and behavioral differences between humans and chimpanzees. And in the rest of our DNA are codes for proteins we share not just with apes, but with many other mammals, and they may influence our capacity for violence. Researchers focused on the role of monoamine oxidases, a family of enzymes that break down neurotransmitters such as serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. These neurotransmitters are often associated with mood regulation. Dopamine is sometimes called the happy hormone, as a lack of dopamine correlates to unhappiness, and sometimes anger. And variations in the genes that code for monoamine oxidases have been linked to increased aggression and violence in animals and humans. However, it would be dangerous to reduce this research down to a simple conclusion that a certain gene mutation might make an individual violent. Any genetic trait will interact with a complicated array of other factors an individual experiences through life. The way a person is nurtured in childhood, the nutrition they receive, the environmental triggers they encounter, such as exposure to abuse, trauma, or stress. No single gene can be isolated as a cause of aggression. Instead, it is likely that multiple genetic and environmental factors interact in complex ways to influence human aggression, although it remains true that within our DNA is written the capacity for violent acts, thanks to the benefits those acts have conferred on us in the past. The observations we can make from our close genetic relatives and the horrifying state of the bones we have uncovered from tens of thousands of years ago all point to this fact. This process of natural selection means that we now carry genes in our DNA that likely influence our aggression through a complicated interplay of hormones and neurotransmitters. But how and when, and to what extent these genes are expressed, is dependent on the context in which we live. And this can be seen even more clearly when we take a step back and view human violence at scale over thousands of years and across billions of people. The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle once wrote, "Neither by nature then, nor contrary to nature, do the virtues arise in us. Rather, we are adapted by nature to receive them, and made perfect by habit." In other words, we are naturally open to receiving moral instruction, and through practice, we develop those morals as habits. He believed that humans are in fact not innately violent. In his many works, particularly Ethics and Politics, Aristotle talked of the social nature of human beings, describing them as political animals, who naturally seek to live in communities and create societies. In the East, Confucian thought aligned with this view, contending that humans were born inherently good, though easily led astray by negative influences. In the 18th century, French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau also believed humans to be naturally peaceful, but argued that civilization was not a symbol of this inherent goodness, but the very thing that lured people away from their inherently pacifist nature. 17th century British philosopher Thomas Hobbes, meanwhile, argued the opposite. To him, humans were indeed innately violent creatures. In his seminal work, Leviathan, Hobbes describes the state of nature as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Hobbes concluded that without the constraints of society and government, humans would be in a constant state of war, driven by fear and the desire for self-preservation. These differing philosophical views ultimately offered two alternate visions. Humans are innately violent, with societal controls keeping us in check, or we are innately peaceful, our desire for community and society a central part of achieving our peaceful goals. And so if we take a step back and look at the development of humanity over time, and in particular the last few thousand years as human civilizations have become more complex and interlinked, we might start to see that perhaps the latter viewpoint could be closest to the truth. Because while much of the archaeological evidence might suggest violence being an inevitable part of our lives, the reality is more nuanced. Despite the many mass graves we find dotted across the globe, historical data shows that humanity has, in fact, generally been peaceful. However, this peace is interspersed with spikes of violence during periods of social instability. When times were good, ancient humans avoided conflicts with neighbors, but things change. Around 14,000 years ago, for example, there was a sudden uptick in archaeological sites holding evidence of more aggressive attacks. This may have been a result of humans beginning to settle and developing shared group identities and culture. And with a deeper sense of community comes something else, a sense of who is not in that community. This may have led early humans to be more protective of their homes and communities, and more ready to attack anyone they saw as a threat. And so we can see the rise and fall of violence throughout history. In the prehistoric world, spikes in violence occurred during the Mesolithic period, approximately 10 to 5,000 years ago, where up to 15% of deaths were caused by human violence. In the Middle East, spikes of violence occurred 6,500 years ago, and again 3,000 years ago. More recently, during the time of colonization, extreme violence was perpetrated by European expansion, for example, into the Americas. Estimations vary, but before contact, the indigenous population is said to have been around 60 million. 100 years later, it was 6 to 7 million. While most of the population is believed to have died through exposure to new diseases, this was still a direct consequence of a forceful and almost universally unwanted occupation. But while these numbers are sobering, they are not representative of a constant state of human aggression and rage. Instead, they reflect periods of significant turmoil and transition. Civilizations rise and fall, and over the centuries, these patterns reveal a cyclical nature to human violence. Surges during times of instability, and decline during periods of stability and growth. The tendency in humans towards more peaceful relationships can be traced back to early social pressures emerging as early as 200,000 years ago, which began shaping human behavior towards more cooperative and less violent interactions. And what happened at this pivotal moment in our history? We started to cooperate and coordinate with each other. One intriguing theory that explains how this correlates with greater peace is the concept of self-domestication. The theory suggests that humans have undergone a form of natural selection, similar to the domestication process purposely inflicted on other animals by humans. This self-domestication is driven by social and environmental pressures within the species itself. The signals of this process include a decrease in reactive aggression, responding to a trigger with violence, the continuation of juvenile traits into adulthood, such as playfulness, and, on a neuroscientific level, more nuanced modulation of neurotransmitters related to bonding and aggression. In the same way that dogs have been bred to be more loyal to humans, to act puppy-like long into adulthood, so too, perhaps, have humans evolved socially to be calmer, friendlier, more jovial creatures. Another overlapping theory for our gradual decline in violence is that it correlates to a development of more complex communication. Some scientists believe humans developed complex language between 200,000 and 300,000 years ago. This ability would have allowed lower status clan members to use a language-based conspiracy, the use of language and communication among individuals to coordinate actions and to keep leaders in check, a concept known as reverse dominance hierarchy. This means, in a nutshell, that lower clan members could talk to each other about their leaders, find consensus, and voice their disapproval. This might have proved more effective and less risky than the old-fashioned way of fighting it out. And so this shift in dealing with conflict might in turn have driven natural selection for alpha males who were less aggressive and more collaborative. A leader who responded calmly and rationally to subordinate male disgruntlement would do better than one who ignored them, pushing the group to a point of violent conflict. According to anthropologist Christopher Bohm, whatever the mechanism by which a man or woman becomes leader, it involves coalitional power rather than individual fighting prowess. However, this theory is not definitively proved. It's difficult for us to accurately pinpoint when exactly language emerged, and as a result, to tie it to a decrease in human aggression. But despite this, the overarching takeaway from anthropological literature is that while humans have the potential for violence, this potential has been subdued by our movement into more cohesive, collaborative group living. Elise Waterston, president of the American Anthropological Association, summarizes this perspective. Humans have the potential, which is different from the tendency, to be violent. And so this distinction is crucial in understanding the broader narrative of human history, which, despite its episodes of intense violence, is predominantly a story of increasing cooperation and peace. As our societies grow ever bigger and ever more complex, we have continued to create systems to manage our relationships. We created leadership roles, from kings to emperors to political leaders. We even devised police forces and judicial systems, prisons, and importantly, strong cultural attitudes, rejecting violence. Today, homicide rates are about 0.6%, much lower than the 2% we observe in primates and in our earlier ancestors. This significant reduction in violence highlights the impact of societal structures and cultural norms in curbing aggressive behavior. And yet, it is not quite the end of the story. We still need to talk about war. While the risk of dying by the hand of an individual may be small, wars continue to blight the world, claiming many thousands of lives. And so while it may be true that the level of violence between individuals has decreased, our crafty and deadly human ingenuity has meant that, when we do decide to fight our neighbors, we can do so on massive scales. As we have developed ever more complex weapons, range weapons like bows and arrows and crossbows, then the invention of gunpowder, leading to the development of firearms, explosives, and eventually nuclear weapons that can travel thousands of miles and kill millions, our capacity for inflicting mass casualties has grown exponentially. We need only to look to World War II, our most recent global conflict and the deadliest of all time. It was a war that involved every continent and resulted in the deaths of between 70 to 85 million people, nearly 4% of the entire world's population at that time. But then, in the 1990s, the end of the Cold War saw a sudden drop-off in mortality in war. Wars were happening, but fewer people were dying in them, and yet we had the most advanced weaponry ever seen. What was going on? This may be a result of wars being fought at a smaller scale, between rebel groups and beleaguered, weak governments, compared to between bigger, richer states. It might also be down to better conflict management, with more targeted, skillful battle plans and long-range weapons protecting soldiers on the ground. We also had the intervention of peacekeeping groups, like the UN. Indeed, perhaps it says something in defense of our more peaceful nature that while we have more deadly weaponry, we are hesitant to use it. But having said this, big wars are on the rise again. More countries experienced violent conflict in 2016 than at any point in the previous 30 years. We are also in a new era of technology, with AI and drones and other precision weapons that could change the way we humans do war. And so only time will tell whether this makes us more or less deadly as a species. So where does this leave us today? We can see how our species evolved from primates, into apes, into modern humans, and onwards into today's worlds of tribes, nations, and states, and with that development, became increasingly peaceful. We are influenced by our media consumption. At no time in history have we ever had so much access to so much information, and it can skew our understanding of how prevalent violence is. But the truth is, while humanity has experienced significant surges of violence during periods of social instability, the broader trend over millennia has been towards greater peacefulness. This evolution has been driven by a combination of social, environmental, and biological factors, reflecting the complex interplay between our genetic heritage and our capacity for cultural and social innovation. Human beings are complicated, messy animals. We are vengeful, angry, brutish, but we are also loving, kind, and peaceful. It is a contradiction that can feel hard to live with. While we continue to wage wars and carry out unspeakable crimes, we can also look back at our past and see how far we've come. Violence is clearly a deep and important part of our history, but so too is peace. You've been watching The Entire History of Humankind.